This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Morning, everyone. It's Joe Bonner and Dee Dee Darimo reading the Wednesday edition of the Cincinnati Enquirer, April 17th. And we'll start with the business page. Mark Williams of the Columbus Dispatch writes this article. Honda's retooled Marysville auto plant will be able to produce both electric vehicles and vehicles powered by internal combustion engines, giving the automaker flexibility amid signs that demand for EVs is slowing. With construction of its battery plant near Jeffersonville on track to be finished by the end of 2024, Honda also says it's making progress retooling its Ohio plants to start making electric vehicles by the end of next year, and making Ohio its EV hub for its North American operations. The EV hub is the starting point for our electrified future, Bob Nelson, Executive Vice President of America Honda Motor, told reporters Friday. It's where Honda associates will develop the knowledge and expertise in EV production that will be shared across Honda's North American auto production network in coming years. Beyond building the EV battery plant in Jeffersonville, with LG Energy Solution, Honda is spending $700 million to retrofit three Ohio plants, the Marysville Auto Plant, East Liberty Auto Plant, and Anna Engine Plant to build electric vehicles and components. Honda expects to hire 300 new workers, while 300 associates at Marysville will train for new job assembling the unit that houses the EV battery and serves as part of the vehicle platform. Honda expects to maintain steady employment across all locations as part of the transition to EVs. EVs don't require as many parts as those that run on internal combustion engines, raising worries among some that fewer workers will be required to make them. The updates that Honda provided Friday come as Honda and Acura prepare for the introduction of its first all-electric SUVs in the North American market, the Honda Prologue and Acura ZDX. Honda's targeting 100% zero-emission sales by 2040. Here are the EV updates at Honda's Ohio plants affected by the transition to EVs. Marysville Auto Plant. The plant has consolidated its two production lines to one so that it can produce EVs and vehicles powered by internal combustion engines on the same line. It's torn out much of its second line. Honda says making ICE vehicles and EVs on the same line, ICE, internal combustion engines, they can do that on the same line, gives it flexibility depending on market demand. We do believe we can efficiently make the ICE and the EV on the same line, and that's what this retooling is about, Nelson said. At the moment, EV sales growth is slowed, according to Kelley Blue Book. EV sales for the first 3 months of 2024 were up from a year ago, but down from the fourth quarter. The additional space from tearing out much of line two will make it easier for workers on the line to move and more efficient for parts delivery and staging for vehicle assembly. Honda has renovated an area of the plant to create a workspace where some 300 associates will start the process of assembling the units that house the batteries. Once production begins, the Marysville plant will supply the units needed for the production of EVs at Marysville and East Liberty. Anna Engine Plant. The plant makes engines and engine components, transmissions, camshafts, and crankshafts. Now it will build the case that houses EV batteries and serves the mainframe structure for the floor of Honda and Acura EVs. The plant will install six 6,000-ton high-pressure die-cast machines that will make the case. The machines are more than 31 feet tall. To create space for the production of the case, the plant has transferred production of engine components for two generations of engines to the Alabama Auto Plant. East Liberty Auto Plant. The plant will have a single production line making heavier weight EVs. Overhead conveyors that carry vehicles through the plant will be strengthened. The paint department will be expanded to accommodate the heavy weight of the EVs. And finally, the Jefferson Battery Plant. The exterior part of more than 2 million square foot building is complete and hiring has started for the plant, including engineering and support positions. Information about the technician and production roles is expected to be announced in the coming months. Honda and LG Energy Solution have committed to invest $3.5 billion in the plant, with the overall investment projected to reach $4.4 billion. And in a second story, this is written by Chuck Michael Lodzak, Dateline New York. He's a writer for Reuters. U.S. stocks closed sharply lower on Monday as an early lift from a strong retail sales report succumbed to a jump in Treasury yields and concerns about rising geopolitical tensions between Iran and Israel. With the S&P 500 coming off its biggest one-day percentage drop since January 31st in the prior session, stocks opened higher in part after data showed retail sales increased by more than expected in March. Also providing early support were gains in some financial stocks after their quarterly results, with Goldman Sachs rising 2.92% as its first quarter profit beat Wall Street estimates, fueled by a recovery in underwriting deals and bond trading that lifted its earnings per share to the highest since late 2021. M&T Bank jumped 4.74% after forecasting better-than-expected annual net interest income, while brokerage Charles Schwab advanced 1.71% despite reporting a fall in quarterly profit. The stocks were the three best performers in the S&P 500 financial sector. But gains faded over concerns the hostilities between Israel and Iran could continue to flare, and Treasury yields jumped with the benchmark 10-year U.S. Treasury note hitting its highest level since November. You saw a little bit of bounce this morning because maybe people thought, okay, it sold off on Friday in anticipation of something really bad happening in the Middle East, said Ken Polcari, managing partner at Case Capital Advisors in Boca Raton, Florida. All the geopolitical stuff is going to cause tension and anxiety in the market. The realization that rates are not going down anytime soon has got to be finally hitting home. That's what the bond market's telling you, that rates are going to go higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 248.13 points, or 0.65%, to 37,735.11. The S&P 500 lost 61.59 points, or 1.2%, to 5,061.82. And the NASDAQ Composite lost 290.07 points on 1.79% to close at 15,885.02. The S&P 500 is now down 2.64 over the past two sessions, its biggest two-day drop since March 2023. The index also closed below its 50-day moving average, a technical support level, for the first time since November 2nd. Israel faced growing pressure from allies to show restraint and avoid escalation of conflict in the Middle East as it considered how to respond to Iran's weekend missile and drone attack launched after a suspected Israel attack on its embassy. Each of the 11 major S&P sectors was lower. Stocks have struggled recently, with the S&P 500 suffering two straight weeks of declines and its biggest weekly percentage drop since October last week, as investors have pushed back expectations for the timing and size of any rate cuts from the Federal Reserve. Apple fell 2.19% as one of the biggest drags on the S&P 500, after data from research firm IDC showed the company's smartphone shipments dropped about 10% in the first quarter of 2024. Tesla jumped 5.6% after the EV maker said it will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce, according to, Tesla didn't jump, it slumped to 5.6%. After the EV maker said it will lay off more than 10% of its global workforce, according to an internal memo seen by Reuters. Salesforce stumbled 7.28% after Reuters reported, citing a source, that the customer relations software maker was in advanced talks to acquire Informatica. On the New York Stock Exchange, declining issues outnumbered advancing ones by a 5.1-to-1 ratio, and on the NASDAQ, decliners outnumbered advancers by a 3.5-to-1 ratio. There were 39 new highs and 138 new lows on the New York Stock Exchange, while on the NASDAQ, there were 37 new highs and 333 new lows.
Turning to the opinion page, today's opinion is sent in by Your Turn columnist Clayton Adams. Commission report seems like more corporate welfare. A group of high-profile individuals known as the Cincinnati Futures Commission has made a lengthy list of recommendations that they think will help our city grow. A few of the commission's ideas seem logical and sensible, like selling off city-owned golf courses and the city's parks and recreation departments working collaboratively to reduce costs and improve efficiency. However, most of the other recommendations in the 74-page report released Thursday appear to be the business community's attempt to strong-arm the city of Cincinnati and residents. The 34-member commission suggested implementing a monthly $15.30 garbage fee, imposing a 0.05% earnings tax increase tax for the purpose of boosting fire and police services, and an additional 0.1% earnings tax hike to create development funds. Most alarmingly, the commission trashed Cincinnati public schools while suggesting the city seek out and promote educational reform efforts. Many of the proposed ideas would financially hurt Cincinnati residents. One of the best benefits of living in Cincinnati is our trash service. Many residents living in our region's suburbs will be the first to tell you how inadequate their trash service is compared to Cincinnati's. Moreover, increasing taxes during record inflation is a poor idea, particularly when the city just received $1.6 billion from the sale of the Cincinnati Southern Railway. Many promises were made during the campaign leading up to the vote on the railroad. We were told how the money would help fix infrastructure and help improve the quality of life for city residents. The commission's recommendations of raising taxes makes it seem like we were duped regarding the sale of the city-owned railroad. It was particularly egregious to bash Cincinnati Public Schools, Ohio's top-performing urban school district. The district has a plethora of strong schools, including many high-performing Montessori schools, immersive language schools, as well as Walnut Hills High School. You would never know from the report, but Walnut Hills High School is one of the top-performing public schools in Ohio and the country. Over the past few years, enrollment at CPS has continued to rise, while many Cincinnati Catholic schools have shuttered due to lagging enrollment. The commission suggested seeking out and promoting educational reform efforts, which exist to hurt public education, not strengthen it. As a CPS teacher, I'm skeptical any time business leaders who do not live in our school district and do not send their kids to CPS talk about reforming public education. Charter schools in Ohio have a long history of corruption and inefficiency. Additionally, Ohio's vouchers program continues to allow taxpayer money to be spent at private schools that are unaccountable to voters and do not accept all students into their schools, particularly students with special needs. Ultimately, the Futures Commission report seems to be yet another opportunity for the business community to promote privatization of public services and assets, while also increasing taxes. On its surface, many of their recommendations seem to be more corporate welfare at the expense of the taxpayer. This city has a long history of handing out tax dollars to private corporations or entities who are not accountable to taxpayers. Examples include tax abatements, TIF districts, and opportunity zones. It would be extremely unfair for everyday city residents to pay more while the wealthy and the corporations they run are paying less. The fact that this report costs the Cincinnati taxpayers $1 million, in combination with the fact that one-third of the commission doesn't even reside in Cincinnati, is disgraceful. Cincinnati voters and taxpayers should meet this report with skepticism until more is known about how these recommendations will improve everyday life for working families in Cincinnati. And the author, Clayton Adams, is a lifelong resident of Price Hill, teacher at Aiken High School, and community outreach chairperson for the Cincinnati Federation of Teachers. I have, three letters to the editor today. First one sent in by Bill Wilsoncroft of Liberty Township. The letters to the editor section of the Inquirer is a great way to test the mood of the country. That said, the logic employed recently by a letter writer from Sharonville in the April 14th newspaper, who feels that President Joe Biden has done a great job over the past 4 years, was so flawed that he either wears rose-colored glasses or is a member of the 1% wealthiest Americans class. The most basic way to compare the past 4 years to the 4 years prior is contained in the simple phrase, peace and prosperity. We have neither under the current president. It's as simple as that. Lawrence Winston of Loveland writes, "Even though my wife and I are pro-choice and want no more children, I can't believe what a CNN poll has found, that abortion is the top issue for 1 out of 8 U.S. voters as we approach the 2024 election. There are many ways to avoid becoming pregnant, and yet with all the issues facing our country, illegal immigration, rampant inflation, rising crime rates, and 2 major wars, myopia has apparently hit over 10% of our population. How sad." And finally, Carol Grayler Law of Kenwood writes, "Who makes up the Futures Commission? Where are all these ideas coming from? Why is there no mention of ways to cut city spending? It seems all the proposals will hit the working members of our city while even taking away some of their pleasures, such as public golf courses. Is this a ploy to get politicians' hands on the money from the sale of the railroad? There does not seem to be a good idea among their suggestions."
Now, turning to the front page of today's Inquirer, first story is written by Sharon Coolidge and Kevin Grasha, both Inquirer staffers. A former Cincinnati Health Department employee accused of taking cash from restaurants in exchange for fraudulent food licenses has been fired for misconduct, including dishonesty and neglect of duty. Court records show that Lisa McGivern, 57, was indicted February 29th on felony charges of theft in office, tampering with records, and forgery. She faces up to 3 years in prison on the theft and tampering with records charges. Forgery is punishable by up to 18 months. McGivern of Fairfield has pleaded not guilty. Her attorney, Courtney DeVincenzo, declined to comment, saying she doesn't comment on pending cases. McGivern was fired on December 7th, officials said. The city of Cincinnati inspects restaurants and, as part of that process, issues licenses to operate. McGivern was one of the employees tasked with overseeing licenses and conducting inspections. A lot about what happened isn't known because police and city officials have declined to talk about details while the criminal case is pending. No one has said how many restaurants McGivern targeted or how much money changed hands and what that's meant for the restaurants. Court documents say the fraudulent transactions took place between February 2023 and December 6, 2023. The indictment says the cash totaled between $7,500 and $150,000. It's important the public knows that we take our commitment to the integrity of our program and serving our community's needs very seriously, Health Commissioner Dr. Grant Mussman said in a statement. The investigation showed that McGivern was the only employee involved, Mussman said. I'm saddened by this case, but it's important to stress that this instance does not reflect the values of the hundreds of employees in this department who do not waver in their dedication to our community. McGivern earned $75,549 a year, city records show. In response to the investigation into McGivern, the city sent a letter and email to its list of current and closed food operators, including restaurants and grocery stores, according to Molly Lair, a city spokeswoman. Businesses that paid cash to McGivern were not penalized for the previous cash payments and were not required to pay again for a valid license. Licenses must be renewed by March 1st, so businesses have since gone through the yearly licensing process, and all licenses are current. Officials have declined to talk specifically about the allegations, including how many restaurants were targeted or paid, but stressed a single employee does not reflect the values or dedication of the health department. The city was swift in its response to an investigation of these allegations, working closely with the law department and Cincinnati police, ultimately resulting in the prosecution of this individual, Lair said. McGivern is the second city employee to be charged this year. A recreation employee was indicted on misdemeanor charges of child endangering. McGivern was hired by Cincinnati's Health Department in 2019. A report that year said she came to the department from Hamilton County Public Health. The Enquirer has requested but not received a copy of her personnel file from the city. She previously worked as a supervisor for the County Health Department in Lansing, Michigan. McGivern resigned from her Michigan job in 2017. The agency, in responding to a Freedom of Information Act request, did not provide any documents to describe the reason or reasons for her resignation. Hamilton County Prosecutor Melissa Powers said in a statement that one of the most important functions of her office is to be a watchdog for the government. When government employees break the law, they should be held accountable, just as anyone else, Powers said. These kinds of corruption issues matter to our community. In this case, you have a government employee exploiting small businesses for her own gain. She used a position of power as an inspector to enrich herself. When we take our families out to eat, we should feel confident in the safety of our food, not worrying that the people doing inspections were more interested in taking cash than doing their job properly.
Cameron Knight writes, lawsuit, deputy lost promotion for wife's social media posts. A former deputy has sued Sheriff Charmaine McGuffey, claiming he was passed over for a promotion due to his wife's social media activity and a single comment he made. Jason Davis and his wife, Jennifer Davis, filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court in Cincinnati Monday against McGuffey, Chief Deputy Sheriff Jay Gramke, and Hamilton County. The couple argues they were retaliated against over a protected speech that ultimately Jason Davis was forced to resign after more than 20 years with the sheriff's office. Sheriff McGuffey issued a statement Monday in response to the lawsuit. We look forward to having our lawyer represent us in this lawsuit because so much of it is untrue, McGuffey wrote. That is the only comment we have at this time regarding the pending litigation. According to the lawsuit, Jennifer Davis made a post on social media in 2020 in response to McGuffey saying COVID-19 was her top priority. Davis's post said officer safety and suicide prevention should be a top priority because line-of-duty deaths and suicides were claiming the lives of more officers than the virus. This person is nothing more than a politician, and is nowhere near qualified to be sheriff, Jennifer Davis wrote. She went on to use a vulgar insult to describe people who voted for McGuffey because of her political party or thought it would be neat to see a gay woman as sheriff. The lawsuit also states that the sheriff's office warned deputies that they and their families should not interact with specific Facebook pages critical of the sheriff. Jennifer Davis liked some posts on those pages. In 2022, Jason Davis organized a Remember the Fallen sporting event and reached out to the Sheriff's Office administration about supporting the event, but never got a response, the lawsuit states. After the event, in response to a question of social media, Jason Davis wrote, "Our department didn't support it. No county items were used to advertise this game. Flyers were taken down from briefing rooms." In 2022, Jason Davis applied for a position in the Regional Enforcement Narcotics Unit, which would have meant for overtime pay and other benefits. That year, he also tested for the position of corporal. In early 2023, he was told he had been selected for the narcotics, but then an hour later was told Gramke had overridden the decision, according to the lawsuit. In July of that year, the lawsuit states he was next in line for the corporal promotion, but heard rumors that he would never get it. At that point, Jason Davis asked for a meeting with Sheriff McGuffey and Gramke, the lawsuit states. The meeting happened in October, according to the lawsuit. Gramke and McGuffey stated that they had issues with Jason's social media post in May of 2022, but more significantly, they had issues with Jennifer's social media posts that were critical of the sheriff, the lawsuit states. Jason Davis said the pair told him there had to be consequences for the social media post and told him he needed to cut loose the people in his life holding him back, which he interpreted as a suggestion he should divorce his wife. Gramke then added that he heard nothing but good things about Jason's performance from his supervision, demonstrating that the only reason for the RENU assignment denial and failure to award him the promotion was the social media activity, the lawsuit states. The lawsuit argues that the actions of the sheriff and Gramke made working conditions for Jason Davis so bleak, difficult, and unpleasant that it constituted a constructive discharge. That's a legal term that means, in part, any reasonable person in his position would have felt compelled to resign. He resigned January 9th and has since been hired at another law enforcement agency at a lower pay rate. The lawsuit argues the First Amendment rights of the Davises were violated and they have suffered financially as personal humiliation and mental distress. The couple is seeking damages of more than $150,000. The case has been assigned to U.S. District Court Judge Michael Barrett. Hearings in the case have not yet been scheduled.
B.B. Hodges and Car Staffer writes this story. You never know what might be in your neighbor's house. One Cincinnatian has a rare and valuable painting from the Northern Renaissance. The 16th century painting, Katharina van Hemessen's Scourging of Christ, 1556, that's the year, is temporarily on display at the Robert A. Deschon and Carl J. Schlachter Library for Design, Architecture, Art, and Planning, otherwise known as DAP Library, at the University of Cincinnati until April the 30th. The anonymous owner loaned the painting, which typically resides in his home. The small jewel-like devotional work is one of the top five museums in the country would die to have in their collections, said Chris Platts, assistant professor of art history at the library and co-curator of the exhibit featuring Hemessen's painting. The painting by the Netherlandish artist depicts the biblical scene of soldiers whipping Jesus Christ before his crucifixion. Platts and Hemessen paid close attention to the musculature of the bodies in the work. It is special, he said, because female painters during this period weren't given the opportunity their male counterparts had to study the human body at an academy. But the painting style isn't what makes it so valuable. The work is the only signed piece by Hemessen in the Western Hemisphere, Platt said. In Europe, there are only roughly 12 signed paintings by her. The work is also one of the four paintings by Hemessen that depicts a religious narrative. Platt said her other works, like most by female Renaissance painters, are portraits. Plus, there are very few female painters compared to men from this period, and even fewer female painters whose work has survived. Platt said she believes very few pieces of the Renaissance art exist in private residence in Cincinnati. A painting like this typically falls in the hands of someone with the means and the taste for it, he said. Usually someone in the art world acquires the painting and it's passed down through inheritance. Before the painting landed in Cincinnati, it was briefly displayed in Detroit. The painting's frame reads, Collection of E. Raymond Field, a previous owner, and exhibited Detroit Institute of Arts. The exhibition in Detroit was one of the only two times in the last 50 to 75 years the Scourging of Christ was publicly displayed, Platt said. Most people don't even know it exists because it's not only on public display, It's not in a lot of Hemison books and articles, he said. So curators who are doing a show on famous Renaissance women or Baroque women artists wouldn't even know about its existence, or if they do, they wouldn't know where to find it, he added. That's what makes it special to have it here. Platts came into contact with the painting about 1.5 years ago when Michael Rezga, a local conservator who represents the anonymous owner, asked him to study the materials used for the painting. Platts later sought the owner's permission to display the painting at the University of Cincinnati. The owner agreed as long as his identity would remain anonymous for safety reasons. The painting's been on display in the library since March the 7th. The exhibit features items from the library's special collections suite that complement the Hemison painting. Together, the items are meant to celebrate Women's History Month by highlighting women artists like Hemison, as well as female rulers and patrons in the Renaissance Europe. Platts confirmed that when the exhibit closes April 30th, the painting will return to the owner's home. He just can't say where.
1 year old died after exposure to lethal mix. This article is by Cameron Knight. A Mount Airy 1 year old who died in February was exposed to a fatal mixture of fentanyl and xylazine, according to court documents. While other children in the county have died from exposure to fentanyl, Hamilton County Coroner Lakshmi Samarko said she believes this is the first child to die from exposure to this drug combination. Kamari Walker was found unresponsible on February 12th in a home on West North Bend Road, police said. Paramedics pronounced him dead at the scene. Last week, 21-year-old Kamani Walker, Kamari's father, was arrested and charged with involuntary manslaughter. According to court documents, the elder Walker had fentanyl and xylazine in an area of an apartment where his son could access the mixture, become exposed, and subsequently die. Samarko said drug combinations with fentanyl account for most of the overdose deaths in the country at this time, in the county at this time. Xylazine, often called Trank, is especially dangerous because it's not an opioid. Therefore, Narcan will not reverse an overdose from it. Used as a tranquilizer for livestock, xylazine is cheap and allows drug dealers to use less of the more costly fentanyl. Its use exploded around 2020, with Philadelphia becoming a hotbed for the drug. There were 86 fatal overdoses in Hamilton County involving xylazine between January and September of 2023, the coroner's office reported. Samarko warned that these combinations of drugs put users at higher risk of overdose. When you buy drugs off the street, you have no idea specifically what compounds are in the drug, at what concentrations, she said. Without knowing any of that, it's hard to gauge the danger. Kamani Walker is being held on a $500,000 bond at Hamilton County Justice Center. A Hamilton County grand jury is expected to review his case by April 15th.
Dan Horn writes this story in Cora Staffer. Almost 200 years after its founder, Joseph Smith, first visited Cincinnati, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints will build a temple somewhere in the city or its suburbs. Leaders of the church made the decision official April 7th during the General Conference in Salt Lake City, where they announced Cincinnati is one of the 15 places worldwide that soon would be home to new temples. Church members, who number about 20,000 in Cincinnati and Dayton area, greeted the news with cheers and tears. Temples are among the most sacred places for Latter-day Saints, also known as Mormons, and construction of the first one here reflects the growth of the church in the region. This is a great symbol of hope for us, said Wesley Foister, president of the Church of Cincinnati North Stake. We expect that it will be a symbol of hope for the community as well. Cincinnati's ties to the Latter-day Saints date to the church's founding in 1830s, when Smith visited the city, sent preachers here, and published the third edition of the Book of Mormon, the doctrinal foundation of the church at a downtown print shop. David Webster, a latter-day saint from Utah who's assisting missionaries in Cincinnati, said the city's history with the church is a source of pride for local members, many of whom have been waiting all their lives for the church to build a temple here. There was a lot of hooping and hollering going on, Webster said of the announcement. It's a big deal. Though church leaders are now committed to building a temple in Greater Cincinnati, a big question remains, where will it be? Foister said the local church leaders haven't been told anything about potential locations, and the church's media office in Salt Lake City did not respond to a call or an email. One possibility is Mason, the growing suburban city north of Cincinnati. Property records from the Warren County Auditor show the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints owns a 35-acre plot of vacant land in the city, just off Mason Montgomery Road and Cedar Village Drive. The church bought the land for almost $7.9 million last September, according to property records. Mason city officials said they have not heard from church leaders about their plans for the site. But Mason city manager Eric Hansen, who's also a member of the church, said the church's announcement and its recent purchases of so much land certainly leads to speculation among the faithful. Having a temple close by, yeah, that's an exciting thing, Hansen said. That's the thing that folks pray for. Hansen said he's aware of no zoning or other restrictions that would prohibit construction of a large religious structure on the vacant land, which is located near offices and other commercial buildings, if church leaders decide to build it there. Temples vary in size, from just under 10,000 to well over 100,000 square feet, but they typically reflect the size of the congregations around them. The one in Columbus is about 12,000 square feet, while the one in Indianapolis is 34,000 square feet. For comparison's sake, the Cathedral Basilica of St. Peter in Chains in downtown Cincinnati is about 23,000 square feet. Temples are significant to Latter-day Saints because they serve a purpose that no other building can. They are where members receive special instruction about God and where they participate in ceremonies that enhance family bonds, a cornerstone of church beliefs. Unlike most Christian churches, temples, which are closed on Sundays, are not where Latter-day Saints go for weekly worship services. Smaller gathering places known as meeting houses serve that purpose. Some church members may go to temple every week, while others go monthly or a few times a year. Distance often determines how often someone visits a temple. Dale Erskine, a church member in Green Township, remembers when the only meeting house in the area was in Norwood, and the nearest temple to Cincinnati was in Washington, D.C. We'd drive all night, he said, then we'd drive back to Cincinnati. The journey shortened in the 1970s when a temple was built near Chicago, and shortened more over the past 25 years as temples went up in Louisville, Columbus, and Indianapolis. But those still are more than an hour's drive from Cincinnati. Erskine said that's why the decision to build a temple closer to home was such welcome news. Joy filled the hearts of many, many, many Latter-day Saints here, he said. Ohio and Cincinnati played an important role in the history of the church. Although Smith founded the church in Fayette Township, New York, in 1830, he lived in Ohio for about a decade and made Kirtland, Ohio, near Cleveland, the de facto headquarters of the early church. A temple built by Smith and his followers in Kirtland still stands. Around the same time, Smith sent preachers to Cincinnati, writing that they should lift up their voice and declare my word with loud voices. According to the Joseph Smith Papers, an archival program overseen by the church, Smith visited Cincinnati himself in 1831 and 9 years later approved the production of the third edition of the Book of Mormon, published by a downtown Cincinnati print shop. It's believed to be the last edition of the Book of Mormon overseen by Smith, who left Ohio for Missouri in the late 1830s with many of his followers. He was killed by an armed mob in 1844 when tensions between Latter-day Saints and those suspicious of the newcomers erupted in violence. Small congregations of Latter-day Saints remained in Ohio, and their number grew modestly over the years. The Pew Research Center estimates they account for less than 1% of the state's population. The first temple in Ohio outside of Kirtland wasn't built until 1999 in Columbus. The temple in Greater Cincinnati, wherever it's built, will be the third in Ohio since construction of the Kirtland Temple. The temple is the gateway to the greatest blessings God has for each of us, said the Latter-day Saints president, Russell M. Nelson, when he announced plans to build one here. The General Conference is among the most important events of the year for Latter-day Saints, and Foister said he and his family watched the announcement live on TV. He said his daughters cheered, his son, a missionary in Central America, sent him a heart emoji, and excited church members started calling and texting one another. I think tears came to my eyes, he said.
Man alleges assault by Covington officer. This article is sent in by Quinlan Bentley. A Northern Kentucky man is suing a Covington police officer over allegations that he was assaulted during a stop. Alexander Kallmeyer filed the lawsuit Wednesday in federal court in Covington, saying Officer Samuel Matthews violated his constitutional rights and used excessive force during an October confrontation. Kallmeyer is seeking compensatory and punitive damages, as well as court costs and attorney's fees. He's also asking for his case to be heard before a jury. According to the lawsuit, Kallmeyer was walking on the sidewalk near 11th Street and Madison Avenue early on October 8th when he was stopped by Matthews, who believed Kallmeyer to be intoxicated after allegedly spotting him crossing the street against a traffic light. While holding his hands out and stepping toward the officer's vehicle, the suit states, Matthews grabbed Kallmeyer by his shoulders and forcefully shoved him towards the police cruiser, thrusting Alex's head into the cruiser. The force of Kallmeyer's head hitting the cruiser caused $500 to $1,000 worth of vehicle damage. The lawsuit says he was knocked unconscious and landed headfirst into a gutter, suffering bruising to his head and body as well as permanent scarring. His lawyers say Kallmeyer did not attempt to resist, pull away, or flee from Matthews, adding the officer's actions were unnecessary and excessive, and the physical contact was without cause or any legal justification. A criminal citation states Kallmeyer attempted to walk away after being told he was under arrest. The officer wrote that physical force was necessary to place Kallmeyer into custody. Body camera video of the indicted shows Matthews placing Kallmeyer onto handcuffs as he lay on the ground and then sitting the man upright on the concrete. Kallmeyer was charged in Kenton County District Court with disregarding traffic regulations, alcohol intoxication, criminal mischief, and resisting arrest. He pleaded guilty in November to the intoxication charge and was ordered to pay a $25 fine. We are aware of the incident. After conversations with Mr. Kallmeyer's attorney and reviewing the evidence, we're going to defend our officer, Dan Hassard, a spokesperson for the city of Covington, said in a statement. Court records do not currently list when the case will go before a judge.
A local buzz. B.B. Hodges, again, Cincinnati Car staffer, writes this. The newest baby animal at the Cincinnati Zoo could be named after you. The Cincinnati Zoo and Botanical Garden is asking the public's help in naming their newborn bat-eared fox, who's now just over 1 week old. The male Kit was born on April 5th at the zoo and is currently doing well in the care of the zoo's neonate specialists and animal care staff, according to the zoo's website. The zoo's animal ambassador team head keeper, Samantha Villa, says the Kit sleeps a lot and makes adorable vocalizations when it's feeding time. His eyes are already open and he's curious about his surroundings, added Andy Hogan, a senior trainer at the Cat Ambassador Program. Do you know a sleepy, curious person who loves to eat? You can try to name the kid after them. The zoo asked sleepy, curious person who loves to eat. You can try to name the kid after him. The zoo asked people to write name suggestions for the baby in the comment section of an Instagram post that features the bat-eared fox squirming in a zookeeper's hands. You can't visit the baby at the zoo yet. The zoo is yet to determine the kit's public debut, which will be announced on the zoo's social media channels. There will be plenty of opportunities to see the bat-eared fox, however. He will be viewable at the cheetah encounter and at some events. He will also become an ambassador animal, which is an animal visitors can often get closer to and learn more about from the zoo's Wild Encounters and Animal Ambassador teams, said Michelle Curley, spokesperson for the zoo. Caretakers are spending time socializing him and making sure that he's comfortable with people. Bat-eared foxes are known for their giant ears and exceptional hearing that helps them locate insects to eat, the zoo said. They also have more teeth than most mammals, which makes it easier for them to consume live prey. Adult bat-eared foxes measure between 18 to 26 inches and weigh 7 to 12 pounds. They're native to eastern and southern Africa and thrive in open grasslands. They're not endangered, but face challenges because of fur hunting and perceived threats to livestock. Zoo-goers can see other young animals throughout May during zoo babies. And today in history, today being April 17th, on this date in 1790, Benjamin Franklin, one of America's founding fathers, passed away at age 84. 1961, a group of 1,400 Cuban exiles, financed and trained by the CIA, landed at the Bay of Pigs in Cuba to launch what was a failed attempt at overthrowing Fidel Castro. 1964, Ford Motor Company revealed the Mustang to the public at the New York World's Fair. The vehicle also debuted on Ford's showrooms across U.S. with a starting price tag of $2,300. Ford sold almost 400,000 of the Mustangs in the first year of production. 1969, Sirhan Sirhan was convicted of assassinating Senator Robert Kennedy on June 5th, 1968. He was sentenced to death but was later commuted to a life sentence in 1972. In 1970, the crew of Apollo 13 returned safely to the Pacific Ocean after a ruptured oxygen tank disrupted a planned mission to the moon. 1972, women were allowed to compete in the Boston Marathon for the first time. Nina Kuscic was officially recognized as the first woman's champion with a time of 3 hours, 10 minutes, and 26 seconds. 1975, the Cambodian Civil War ended as the rebel communist forces of the Khmer Rouge captured the capital and Cambodian government surrendered to Rouge leader Pol Pot. And finally, in 1993, Los Angeles police officer Lawrence Powell and Sergeant Stacy Kuhn were convicted of violating Rodney King's civil rights by a federal jury. They were involved in the brutal beating of King, which sparked civil unrest and riots across the city.
Kevin Grasha writes, judge sets firm trial date for teen charged in 4 killings. A teen who is believed to be the only juvenile in Hamilton County's history to be charged with murder in 4 separate killings has to decide by the end of the month whether to plead guilty. All 4 killings happened when Makeem Thomas was 14 years old. Thomas, now age 17, appeared Friday in Hamilton County Common Pleas Court, looking like a high school student, wearing a light gray polo shirt and glasses. He is being prosecuted as an adult, but because of his age has been held at the County Youth Center for 3 years. It was possible that Thomas could have pleaded guilty Friday, but one of his attorneys, Hal Ehrenstein, said in court that with all the moving parts, there is a problem. Family members of the 4 homicide victims were in the courtroom, along with 4 Cincinnati police detectives who investigated the killings. Assistant Prosecutor Linda Scott said Thomas now has to decide by April 29th whether to plead guilty or to go to trial. After that date, Scott said, there will be no more offers by the state, no more plea negotiations by the state. Judge Robert Gehring said if there isn't a plea, the trial would begin on September 9th. The first killing happened October 25th, 2020, in South Fairmont. Prosecutors say it began as a robbery that Thomas helped set up. It ended with one of Thomas's alleged accomplices being killed. On February 1st, 2021, prosecutors say Thomas used Facebook to set up a meeting with two people in South Fairmont. According to prosecutors, he went to the location and fired multiple shots into a vehicle, killing 19-year-old Terrence North and wounding another person inside the vehicle. Thomas also is accused of being one of three people who on February 16, 2021, were hired by Carl Godfrey to kill a man to whom Godfrey owed money. Thomas and two others, according to testimony at Godfrey's trial earlier this year, fired 21 shots into an SUV outside a Westwood apartment complex, wounding the intended target and killing 27-year-old DeAndre Otis. That night, according to court documents, Thomas texted Godfrey and asked, when is the pay hitting for that? Huh. I guess, hire for kill or whatever. When Godfrey responded that the hit wasn't successful, Thomas texted, what's next? 2 days later, prosecutors say Thomas went with Godfrey to Millvale to retaliate for Godfrey's car being shot up the previous day. At least 19 shots were fired, but prosecutors say they didn't shoot their intended target. Instead, 30-year-old Danelle Steele was caught in the line of fire and killed by a single gunshot to his eye. Thomas was in custody the following month. He is facing 27 counts, including murder and attempted murder. Wow.
Max Philby of the Columbus Dispatch writes this article. Alzheimer's disease is continuing to take its toll on one of the nation's best-known and beloved zookeepers. Jack Hanna, who became famous for appearing on talk shows with animals by his side, has reached an advanced stage of Alzheimer's, his family said. Hanna, 77, served as director of the Columbus Zoo from around 1978 through 1992, and was first diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2019. The progressive disease is most common form of dementia and typically causes memory loss and language issues and can eventually affect a person's ability to carry out activities that are part of daily life, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. We wish we had good news to share, but Jack continues to decline and has all the symptoms one would anticipate with advanced Alzheimer's. Each day, we do our best to find joy, even when things are challenging. We hope that sharing Jack's diagnosis of Alzheimer's brings awareness to the disease that affects almost 7 million Americans and their families, the family said in a prepared statement to the Dispatch and People's Magazine. In 2023, the Hanna family allowed the Dispatch to visit the famed zookeeper at his Big Fork, Montana home. Hanna, who called Columbus home for years and was still associated with the zoo, said at the time that he had no memory of whether he'd been to Ohio's capital city. The Dispatch's visit marked the first time the Hanna family had spoken publicly about their struggle with Alzheimer's. The family said they wanted to speak out to raise awareness about the disease that affects an estimated 6.7 million people in the United States, according to the Alzheimer's Association. We're so grateful for the love, support, Privacy Central Ohio has shown to Jack and our family since this diagnosis. Jack cherished his community, the zoo, in the wilds, said the Hanna family recently told in the Dispatch. Our thoughts are with the many families also impacted by Alzheimer's disease.
FAFSA help is on the way as U.S. tries to correct botched rollout, and this article is by Sheridan Hendricks. More than a million students and families eager to correct their FAFSA forms, that's F-A-F-S-A, and be one step closer to making a college decision, hopefully won't have to wait much longer. This comes as the nation has seen a dramatic decline in how many free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA, forms have been completed because of a difficult, at best, rollout of the 2024 program. In a letter sent to college administrators last week, U.S. Department of Education Secretary Miguel Cardona acknowledged that this year's FAFSA has come with a number of setbacks, frustrations, and challenges. The FAFSA got a long-awaited facelift in late December, which federal education officials promised would make the forms easier to complete. But families and students anxious to apply for the financial aid were forced to navigate a slew of issues with the rollout. The form typically is available in October, but was delayed for 3 months. Cordona said the goal is to make the ability to correct forms available sometime early this week. Upwards of 1,120,000 forms, about 16% of the 7 million FAFSA applications submitted so far, need to be corrected by a student or family member before the U.S. Department of Education can process their form, according to the department. Some of these issues include missing student or parent signatures or consent and approval from the student to retrieve federal tax information. Another 30% of forms have been affected by miscalculations and tax errors, but fixing those forms will take longer. Colleges are holding off on sending financial aid packages to students until they feel confident that issues with the FAFSA form are resolved and the data they receive is accurate. In a concerted effort to get FAFSA completion rates up, the White House and Department of Education announced that this week will be FAFSA Week of Action. I Know I Can, the only area nonprofit organization focused on helping students in Columbus City, Southwestern, and two other neighboring districts with college access, grants, and career readiness, is helping with local students and families dealing with the FAFSA issues get back on track. The organization is offering FAFSA help sessions throughout the week for students and families with its office at 215 North Front Street, and walk-in appointments are welcome.
Well, that, I think, concludes today's program.
Have a good day, folks.